Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want. Your weekly movement news roundup.
Hello, today is the 8th of March, a very important day, the 8th of March 2024. As most of you watching this show would know, it's International Working Women's Day, as we celebrate it across the world, a very powerful day of mobilizations, a day with a lot of rich history, a history of struggle, a history of battling against the odds, and a very important day. And so we're very happy to do this show today. This is Give the People What They Want, your favorite weekly news analysis show brought to you by People's Dispatch. That's Zoe and I, and Globetrotter Vijay is once again traveling as part of a reporting assignment, so he will be back next week. Like I said, a very significant day today. Today is March 8th, and I think all the more important because of the ongoing struggles in Palestine. I will come back to that with Zoe a bit later, but important to note that we have crossed 5 months since Israel's genocidal, Israel's brutal war on Gaza began. And I think it's very important that as people who consume the news, as people who are part of movements, we do not fall into the trap of treating this as everyday news, which is always a risk with developments of these kinds, which continue for so many months. It is very essential that this not be allowed to sort of fade into the background or become that kind of static, so to speak, because the inhuman nature of this war becomes evident by the day, it becomes clearer by the day, its impact on the lives of the over 2.1 million people in Gaza continues to escalate by the day. And, you know, we also, as journalists, we think it's very important that this not just become numbers. The numbers are staggering, the numbers are shocking, but behind every number is the story of a family destroyed, the story of so much destruction brought on people. And we're looking at around 31,000 deaths at this point. We're looking at over 74,000 injuries, if I'm not mistaken, at this point. But these are, like I said, this is just the beginning. We're talking about an all-round systemic collapse of the lives of all these people in Gaza. And we need to remember, of course, that South Africa did bring a case against Israel in the International Court of Justice, accusing it of violating the Genocide Convention. The ICJ, in its response, found a lot of substance to South Africa's claims. One of the recommendations the ICJ made very strongly was that Israel be very clear, Israel take responsibility for the delivery of aid, increase the amount of aid delivery to the people of Gaza. And I think a UN Security Council resolution also had a similar mandate a couple of weeks ago. We have a report on it that has just gone up. And that actually shows that, contrary to what the ICJ said, in fact, the amount of aid that is going in has actually come down. And this is having a horrendous impact. Now, it's very, very important to remember that Gaza was already under siege before, that this is not the first time that Gaza has been under attack. Gaza was already under siege before, and it was under siege for over a decade and a half. So already a lot of food, a lot of medical supplies, a lot of other necessities of life were being provided to the people of Gaza through relief trucks. And this is what has been drastically cut since Israel's war began. So at some point, we were looking at around 500 trucks going to Gaza. And whereas right now in February, according to the UNRWA, just 98 trucks entered per day, as opposed to the 500 trucks a day. And even in January, we were getting about 200 trucks a day. So in almost what is some kind of perverse logic, we see that after the ICJ delivered its verdict, we've actually seen a decrease in the number of relief trucks. And the impact of this is, it's been horrendous in so many ways. We're looking at, of course, medical supplies massively declining. We're looking at people struggling for food. Most importantly, we're looking at famine. The latest reports say that about 20 people have died due to malnutrition and dehydration, which basically means in the year 2024, people are dying of hunger in Gaza, and this number is likely to increase. And this is a direct result of Israel's refusal to actually allow more aid. It is not that the aid is not there. The aid is very much there. It is not that the trucks are not there or the agencies are not there. They're there. But Israel just refuses to let them enter. Now, we saw some days ago that the United States actually airdropped some aid in Gaza as some kind of bandage, considering that its own policies have allowed Israel to continue this blockade. It continues to arm Israel, so it's almost a farce in some senses. And Biden, in his recent address, we'll talk about that, as we'll talk about that later, talked about building some kind of humanitarian pier in Gaza to download supply, to disembark supplies. But the real question is, why is that necessary, considering that this aid is very much there at the borders? So I think a very important question before the ICJ, of course, when it hears the matter, but also before journalists, also before people's movements across the world in terms of how they choose to respond to this.
Well, that's exactly right. And Prashant, as you said, today is International Working Women's Day. And it's a day of mobilization. It's a day of struggle. And today, millions of women across the world are using this day to continue and to intensify their struggle against foreign complicity in the genocide in Gaza, specifically, of course, the Global North countries that are financing and politically backing Israel as it carries out 5 months of genocide. And people are demonstrating their solidarity with the Palestinian people, the Palestinian women and children who have been massacred by Israel for over 5 months again, saying that the struggle, the feminist struggle, is an anti-imperialist struggle. The feminist struggle is a struggle against Zionism, against imperialism in the region. And this is, this goes beyond slogans. We're not just saying that, people are not just saying that, supporting Palestine is feminist thing. It's actually very concrete. The impact on women and girls during this genocide has been atrocious. Over 25,000 of people who have been killed by Israeli forces are women and children. Miscarriages in Palestine since the beginning of Israel's genocidal war have increased by 300%. There's the access that women in Gaza have to healthcare, to treatment, has also been severely, severely restricted. We know that one of the key targets throughout these 5 months have been precisely hospitals and healthcare centers. And again, women who are pregnant, who are needing prenatal care, postnatal care, and actually are giving birth, are in of huge, huge, huge impediments to actually getting the care that they need, let alone the nutrition that they need. You already spoke about the extreme cutting off of aid. I mean, we've seen horrific, horrific images this week. Already there's deaths by malnutrition, and a lot of those are children and babies. In addition, it's really horrifying. So I'm just going to try to go through some of these stats, because when we say that, the Palestinian cause is really at the center of the feminist struggle, it's really material and it's very concrete. One in 10 Palestinian women in labor are delayed reaching hospitals because of military checkpoints. And this was, already the situation. Many women, whether it's in Gaza or in the West Bank, have to go through multiple military checkpoints where often they're stopped, they have to do some sort of procedure. Again, this already impedes their ability to give birth safely and to have access to the necessary care that they need. So there's so many different manifestations of this. And so we're seeing that movements across the world who have been very active over the past several months in the Palestine Solidarity Movement are once again today taking to the streets. There's, for example, the International People's Assembly and the World March of Women today launched a poster exhibition of solidarity with Palestinian women and reaffirming, the centrality of the Palestinian cause to the feminist movement. There are going to be mobilizations again across the United States in several cities with this same kind of slogan. I think it's a really interesting moment again, especially for movements that for many years have been trying to make this very concrete connection between the anti-imperialist struggle and the anti-patriarchal struggle. And it's interesting because last night, and I'll talk about it a bit later, but last night was the State of the Union, and you see all of these senators and representatives from the United States who themselves are so complicit in advancing Israel's genocide and to supporting it, and allegedly you know, they talk about women's rights, they talk about women's right to choose, they talk about being feminist, and at the same time, they're actually supporting a genocide, which is directly targeting women, which is directly targeting girls. So this has been a moment of great clarity of saying that this is not really the feminism that actually is a true feminism. And this the true meaning of actually fighting for women across the world has been made very, very clear in these months. And I think especially today on International Working Women's Day, it is, again, a central issue.
Right. Zoe, of course, you mentioned the struggles that are taking place across the world. And I think it's also important to, while talking about Palestine, to remember that these struggles are taking place across the world. They have been taking place for many months, for over 5 months now, in terms of the number of marches taking place almost on a weekly basis. We saw massive mobilization on the 2nd of March, multiple mobilizations otherwise taking place. And these are really mounted, and these definitely have been one wing of resistance to Israel and its ally, the United States, its other allies in the West, when it comes to the impunity they have been enjoying. But also important to note that this war has had some regional ramifications that have also extended to the question of resistance itself. We're talking, of course, about what is called the axis of resistance and, you know, the kind of impact it has had in the past few months. And I think there are two aspects to talk about on this. One is, of course, that there was a certain trend towards normalization of relations with Israel that was kind of getting increasing power among the countries in West Asia, that is becoming a very, very powerful trend, the tendency towards normalization, and that has really suffered a blow with, you know, with October 7 and the developments past it. We have a great article which chronicles what has happened since October 7th on that front. And an important thing is that the Palestinian people's struggle, their refusal to accept defeat, their refusal to give up, has been a key factor in many of the Arab governments kind of being forced to withdraw from the paradigm of normalization. Now, of course, they're not going to give up, absolutely. But nonetheless, the fact remains that they have been forced to sort of withdraw from that paradigm. And that's definitely a very interesting development. But also we see what, for instance, Hezbollah and Ansar Allah, known as the Houthis, have been doing, very, you know, really shaking up the entire region. Hezbollah from October 8th onwards itself expressing solidarity with Palestine, targeting the Israeli military facilities. Now Israel responding very brutally as well. The number right now, I think, is around 300 people in Lebanon have been killed in Israeli strikes, a majority of them civilians. Hezbollah has, of course, also fired back. So hardly a week goes by without the kind of crossfiring that we've seen. And in some senses, I think if we need to sort of, it's a very delicate situation. On the one hand, Hezbollah has, of course, stayed back from declaring a full-fledged attack. Israel has been making extremely threatening noises. You have the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, actually saying that even if a truce is reached in Gaza, we will continue to attack Lebanon. So very, you know, a very delicate situation over there. But it has also meant that Israeli forces are, to some extent, they're kind of tied up in the north, and that has been a very active sense of, active action of resistance on the part of Hezbollah. And if you look at what Ansar Allah has been doing, again, very, very significant, choosing to target, first ships taking materials to and from Israel, and then Israeli, and then US and British ships, and making a very clear point that, you know, its solidarity is not just, of course, it's on one aspect of the solidarity is the millions of people who have been taken to the streets in Yemen very regularly. And that, you know, the numbers have been quite, the numbers have been immense. But it is also very active solidarity in the sense of targeting what Israel has been doing as well. So, so all these together have really kind of, I think, shaken the region. There's no going back to the pre-October 7 situation, whether it be for the pro-normalization governments or whether it be for the axis of resistance. I think the kind of hegemony that the United States enjoyed in this region is no longer there. It's become much more shaky right now. So there's no, you know, the kind of dominance it had at some point is definitely not there. It's become way more shaky. Even the kind of relationships Israel was building with many of these countries have become much, much more dicey, so to speak. So altogether, this the region is looking at a major transformation. It's already transformed. It's not looking at a major transformation. Now, of course, the pro-Israel and pro-US forces are likely to maybe push to reverse some of these developments, but I think in the long run, it would be very difficult to do that. There is a wave of for radicalism that is taking over the entire world on this issue. Millions of people being politicized, millions of people changing their perspectives, millions of people realizing what has been happening in Palestine for the longest time over the past 5 months, and that is definitely not going to be the one.
Well, also being forced to take a different position is Joe Biden himself. And again, not in any sense of really changing his policy or doing anything so differently, but Joe Biden has actually, last night we saw it in the State of the Union, that he spent considerable time actually talking about the civilian death toll in Gaza. And we saw that there was a small group of Cori Bush and Rashida Tlaib who were wearing kufiyas during the State of the Union address. Other Democrats and Republicans actually wearing little stickers that said 153, which is the number of days since Israel began its genocidal war. Of course, they're actually talking about the number of days that the hostages have been held by Hamas. A very interesting presentation, perhaps, by Joe Biden. In many senses, it can be seen as sort of a campaign rally. He sort of talked about all these things that he wants to do if he's able to continue his term in office. Pretty interesting, because he points out that if he is elected again, that he will codify Roe v. Wade, which is pretty funny because he did have a democratically controlled Congress. And this has been, again, Roe v. Wade was, you know, on the books for decades, and it was never taken forward by any of the Democratic presidencies or the Democratic controlled Congresses to actually make it a law. So he kind of was using this platform to do a lot of campaign promises. And again, he spoke. It's very, very clear that Biden is actually under a lot of pressure regarding the situation in Gaza. He spoke extensively about, as I said, the civilian death toll, and about the efforts that his administration has been making to really push for peace, which many people pointed out. And Ilhan Omar was actually holding a sign that said, "Stop sending bombs," which is, again, this paradox of the Biden administration, which has now been forced to say that they care about civilian lives, but at the same time are pushing to get $14 billion of aid to Israel. At the same time that Joe Biden was giving this State of the Union address, there were hundreds of protesters outside in Washington, D.C., holding the People's State of the Union, blocking major intersections with a huge Palestinian flag. There were speeches, sort of a concert atmosphere, and really just speaks to the fact and of this constant mobilization and the constant pressure that U.S. politicians have been under. Again, this week was also Super Tuesday, which we saw Donald Trump essentially clinching the Republican candidacy for this upcoming elections in November. Nikki Haley dropped out. Joe Biden, again, he won largely most of the states in Super Tuesday, but there was sort of this unexpected growth in what is called the uncommitted vote, which is Democrats, registered Democrats voting in these primaries and essentially saying that they're not committing to voting for Joe Biden. This is a movement that's actually grown in the past several months due to his extreme support of Israel during the genocide. And so there's been this growing movement to call on voters to not support Joe Biden and to say that he can't have the Democratic vote unless he actually takes concrete steps to stop the genocide. We saw that in Massachusetts and North Carolina. This was growing in Hawaii, actually, which again is a U.S. colony. It got even more traction, this uncommitted vote. Previously, it had done over 10% in Michigan, which is where this movement kind of started. So we're actually seeing that the Democrats are facing increasing pressure for their kind of complete support of this policy. It will be interesting to see how this plays out in November. Are people, which way is this uncommitted vote going to swing when it comes to the presidential elections in November? We know that there are a bunch of third party options that are actually growing in strength as well and gaining momentum. Of course, the PSL ticket of Claudia de la Cruz and Karina Garcia, the Green Party again with Dr. Jill Stein. People are more and more seeing that the two-party system in the United States is actually perhaps not really working in their favor. So it's a very interesting moment, this uncommitted vote, the unprecedented growth of saying no to the Democratic establishment is certainly a historic development in U.S. politics.
Right. Of course, we have moved on to what is one of our favorite topics on this show, that is the question of elections. And like you've been talking about in almost every episode, 2024, the year of very important elections in every part of the world. One election that seemed a bit unlikely to take place, there was a lot of uncertainty about what would take place, was the election in Senegal. President Macky Sall basically declared that the election, which was supposed to be held towards the end of March, his term is supposed to expire on April 2nd. Sall suddenly overturned the whole process, got Parliament to pass a motion postponing the elections to December, causing a huge amount of consternation in the country. Protests also taking place. I think about four people died in those protests as well. But Macky Sall's plan finally not working out. We have a detailed copy from our colleague Tarupriya on that. Please do check it out on the site. But what is going to happen is that the elections will take place on the 24th of March. Now, this follows a lot of negotiations and pushes and pull. There was a constitutional council, which, very senior, the highest court, which also ruled on this matter. And basically, while the president did keep trying to push the election as much as possible, finally the decision was to hold it on the 24th of March. Now, Macky Sall will not be contesting in this election. He had already, initially hesitated a while ago to sort of declare that he would announce that he would not contest, leading to another round of protests, which led to many deaths as well. And finally, he was forced to accept that he would not contest it because his constitutionally mandated terms are over. But his successor from his coalition, the incumbent prime minister, is likely to contest, but is not very popular. And in fact, that was seen as the reason by many for Macky Sall to try to postpone the election so that he could maneuver the situations so that his coalition might win. But so now that has definitely not worked out. But a very important time for Senegal as well. Macky Sall announced some kind of an amnesty program for people who have been arrested during two rounds of protests that took place in Senegal in 2021 and 2023. Hundreds of people were arrested. The number could be as high as 1,500. So while this amnesty law was announced, there was a lot of pushback against it because it did not necessarily clarify the fact that there were political prisoners. And secondly, there was no, it was not an unconditional release. And also that there was no accountability for those who were involved in atrocities from the side of the government. So going to be a very interesting election. We'll be closely covering it, happening in exactly about 2 weeks from now. And Senegal is a country where there has been an increasing amount of rise in the anti-imperialist sentiment that we've been noticing across West and North Africa. Macky Sall, for instance, seen as a client of the French government, extremely unpopular for that reason, also for his economic policies, but also because of the perception that he has pretty much implemented the French agenda in that region at a time when anti-French sentiment has been extremely high. We have talked about the coups in Mali, in Burkina Faso, for instance, in Niger. So at this point of time, Macky Sall has been one of the old guard, preserving the old system, and there's been a huge amount of opposition. Key opposition leaders have been imprisoned, like for instance, Ousmane Sonko, very powerful leader of what is called the Pastef Party, PASTEF, is in prison. Another key presidential candidate also has been excluded. So despite all this, we're definitely going to see a very tough contest, and I think the kind of churn that is going to come out of it will determine Senegal's future in the coming months. Will Macky Sall give in to the verdict of the people Will that be respected? I think that's a very important question that we need to wait and see. So one of the most important elections in that region and for Africa as a whole, definitely taking place on the 24th of March as of now. So keep watching this space. We'll come back to you when the election takes place and when the results are out.
Well, another key election which is going to be taking place in July this year are the presidential elections in Venezuela, which we know, again, are not just a national event in a sense, but really impact the region and are a key event, again, for the United States. Elections are always a time when the United States, again, positions itself against Venezuela and its Bolivarian process. And we've already seen that this is taking place. When the Venezuelan Supreme Court barred the candidacy of the far-right activist, Maria Corina Machado, the United States said that it would not renew the licenses that it had made with the oil companies, and that it would reactivate some of the sanctions that it had made that it had previously suspended against the sector. It also made sweeping condemnations of Venezuelan democracy, saying that these would not be legitimate elections. Again, reactivating this very strong anti-government discourse that it is so fond of. This week on Tuesday, the date for the elections in Venezuela was confirmed for July 28th. This comes again days after a national agreement was signed by hundreds of different civil society organizations and political parties in Venezuela that had come together in dialogue to discuss the electoral process. What are the guarantees that need to be there? What could a possible calendar look like? And other elements of electoral process, will there be observation? Through these agreements and through this kind of plural dialogue, they've decided to invite several different international entities to observe the elections, saying that, you know, the US, the European Union love to condemn Venezuelan democracy, but they have actually said that the Carter Center, the EU and other international bodies are welcome to observe these elections. They have full confidence in the electoral process. And they have actually frequently reiterated the reasons and the grounds for why this far right wing Venezuelan political leader would not be able to run in the elections, citing her support for US sanctions, her participation in fomenting of the anti-democratic protests, which took place in 2014 and 2017, popularly known as the Guarimbas, which were violent protests attempting to undermine, again, democratic rule of law and order in Venezuela. We know that in, for example, 2017, over 100 people were killed in these protests. Many Chavistas, there was one case of a young Chavista that was burned alive by these right-wing protesters. So we're not talking about, just someone who was participating in marches. And we know that actually a lot of opposition parties are going to be participating in these elections in July. But really, again, so this has been the sticking point, the exclusion of this candidate, but really it's just a pretext for Washington to again reactivate its policy of aggression against Venezuela. But as we know, and as we've been covering for the past several years, the regional equation is quite different. We're not looking at a scenario where the entire region is ruled by conservative governments. For many years, Colombia was a huge an important ally of the United States in their attacks against Venezuela. Iván Duque specifically was quite eager to actually join in the attacks. We know that many mercenaries were training on Colombian soil to then carry out operations against Venezuelan leaders, against Venezuelan national territory. But now we're looking at a situation where, you know, many of Venezuela's neighbors are ruled by countries that actually would like to see democracy triumph, would actually like to see a sovereign region, a region that works together. Lula da Silva has also said that whoever wins the elections in Venezuela, that is the decision of the people. So I think the US is also having to recalibrate its strategy, given that they're not really dealing with a favorable situation in the region. They don't They can't bend the will of the governments that are surrounding Venezuela to put pressure on it like they were able to before. So it's definitely going to be an interesting couple of months leading up to this electoral process. As the Venezuelans say, every time there are elections, it's again another test of the revolution and another moment for the people to recommit themselves to the revolutionary process. So we'll definitely be following that. It's a very, very important moment. Nicolas Maduro is going to be the candidate for PSUV and the coalition. And so very, very interesting. Will the revolution continue? That will be decided again on July 28th, the birthday of Hugo Chavez, who, again, the death anniversary of was on March 5th. So again, we love to cover elections. We'll be following Venezuela in July, Mexico in June. Very exciting couple of months coming up for the region and, of course, for the world.
Right. And that is all we have in this episode of Give the People What They Want. Do tune in next week as well. Hopefully, Vijay from Globetrotter will be back. And right now, this is Zoe and me from People's Dispatch signing off. See you next week.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall.